Hey, welcome back to another episode of Old School Guns, the podcast that has the news, opinion, and answers that you want to know. First, let me tell you how lucky you are getting this exclusive content. And the reason I'm laughing is because I've actually submitted the podcast to two different firearms networks and haven't heard from either of them. So my assumption is they're not interested. They're probably not interested for a couple of different reasons. Number one is I don't really dig the Muzak that people use. You know, it's even... You really can't use any kind of well-known music without violating copyrights, which I just am really unwilling to do. And I really don't want to go, free music all sounds like stuff you hear in an elevator or in a department store. So I'm not gonna really do that. The next thing is I don't have a lot of expensive equipment. As you can probably tell, there's not a lot of expensive equipment here. So, you know, it's just a computer, a microphone, and I do have some bulletized notes, not a script, but just some notes. The next thing is, although I have a degree in communications, I don't really want to be a broadcaster, a slicky boy like, Ron Burgundy. I'm kind of a big deal. I'm not a big deal. I speak very, very much off the cuff. I don't really want to be that person who's got a lot of rehearsed answers or is reading from a script. There are a couple of YouTube creators, and when you read, you click on their channel, and they're reading from a script, and it's terrible. It absolutely is terrible. It's it's kind of like watching the Charlie Brown cartoons and hearing the teacher in the background going, wah, 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 wah. That's kind of what it sounds like after a while. You know you're getting some rehearsed, edited piece of garbage. Frankly, that just doesn't interest me. The thing is, I don't have a co-host or any guests. And that may change in the future. I'd like to have a co-host or guest. There are a couple possibilities out there. But they have to be interesting and bring something to the discussion. And there are some of those guys out there, and I would like to really very much talk to some of the industry people out there and some of the people who've been around for a long time. And I think that there's some great perspectives out there. There's a lot of reality that really needs to come into some of the content that you see and hear. Definitely one interesting guy who's still around is one of the better gun writers who emerged out of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and that is Massad Ayoub, who had a law enforcement background and published, had a small kind of publishing company, and published some really good references for law enforcement and armed citizens. And used to be that, you know, you would have to write away to this little company. I think it was called Policeman's Bookshelf. That's what I think it was called. And you could get his books. And I mean, you found the ads for it in the back of a gun magazine, and you basically had to write away and get a price list and then buy stuff. And it probably his best book that. And I've read a couple of his books. I really haven't read them in a while, but the one book that made the biggest impact on me was called In the Gravest Extreme. And In the Gravest Extreme, it kind of went over, okay, you have a shooting. What's going to happen afterwards? And what is going to transpire? And he kind of goes through how the police will investigate, and if it's not exactly clean, you could be, or if they can throw some shade on it, there's definitely, you could go to trial, and you will need professional witnesses, and here are things that you, before this even happens, things you should and should not do. So there was a whole thing. Now, whether or not that is all still applicable, or the legal points and some of that is definitely up for debate. But the thinking that he got my mind into, and I think other people's minds, is, hey, this isn't all fun and games. This isn't Dirty Harry where you smoke the bad guy, you put a hole in him, and end his life and think that, you know, 2 hours later, you're going to be watching a football game or going to the park or anything else. No. When you pull that trigger, you are in for months, if not even a couple of years, of heartburn. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of things. Even if it's a clean shooting and everything's good, we now see that the victim's family, and it's usually some blubbering mother who says, this was a good boy, and he didn't do anything wrong, and all this. All of that basically leads to a civil suit. And then you've got to defend yourself. Not only do you have to worry about a criminal case, but even if you're completely exonerated, they don't press any charges and you're good to go, there's going to be some sort of civil suit following that, especially if they think you have any kind of assets or money. And they could, should they prevail, which I think the bar is a little bit lower, but if you've been exonerated, I think that's a big plus on your side. But you know, you get the wrong kind of a jury, the wrong kind of a judge, a lawyer makes a mistake, and all of a sudden you've lost everything. You've lost everything, even though you didn't do anything wrong. And that's a risk you take when you pull the trigger. You own that bullet when it leaves the firearm. That's what I got out of it. That's helped shape a lot of what I do. You know, it's like, you don't want to be, and you see it in road rage cases, you know, people flashing a firearm, you know, somebody's tailgating you, this starts with the hand signs, and it may be a few shouts, and then somebody might be flashing a firearm. Best thing to do is get away from that, and you won't look like the big hero in front of everybody, but what you're doing is the smart thing. Best thing to do is de-escalate and get out of the situation. You know, I have about a 30-45 minute commute to work, depending on traffic and things. And I can tell you, even riding at the speed limit in the slow lane, I will get people tailgating me. And I can never figure that out, except I think a lot of it is people are fooling with cell phones, and they may not have evil intent, but it definitely, you know, it makes you mad when it's like, hey, I'm in the slow lane, I'm going the speed limit. So it's not like I'm driving at, you know, 20 miles an hour, and this person's tailgating me, and you know that will make you mad. That will definitely, you know, definitely piss you off. But what I found is the best thing to do is realize, A, they probably don't intend to annoy you or to try to hassle you. That it just may be non-thinking on their part or inattention. But what I normally do is, or sometimes, you know, when you're passing a vehicle and you're not going fast enough, even though you may actually be going over the speed limit, just to get around somebody. Somebody comes up, you know, and they're riding on the bumper. Best thing to do is just move over, let them go. Don't get into a hassle. I would say drive very inoffensively. Don't even stare at them. Don't even look at them. Don't get that personal interaction with the person in the other vehicle, and don't be making hand signs and all the rest of this stuff. That stuff isn't cute anymore, and it can get you into real trouble. I also find if I'm in the slow lane and somebody's tailgating me, what I do is just start gradually slowing down. No, I don't slam on the brakes. I don't try to scare them. I just start gradually slowing down. Eventually, they kind of get the word that, hey, man, I don't want to be, you know, going 10 miles under the speed limit here behind this guy. They'll just come out and pass you, and everybody moves on. Then you can speed up. Everybody moves on. So, but getting back to In the Gravest Extreme, it's the kind of book everyone should read and realize that, you know, it's not fun and games. It's not Wyatt Earp in Tombstone, although even he had blowback after the OK Corral shoot. They were charged and had to go through a process. So, you know, understand it's not what you see in the movies. And they're going to confiscate the gun you use. They're going to treat you like a criminal until they investigate. And then, you know, the hopefully the benefit is they decide not to charge you. And then you've got to prepare, at least be prepared for defense in a civil case. You know, there was always a lot of advice that went around. Don't use hand loads for self-defense. I don't think that's ever a good idea. Simply not because hand loads can be portrayed in court as some sort of super cartridges that you made to kill people, but simply because, you know, being a hand loader for a long time, you know, a lot of hand loads just aren't as reliable as factory ammo. So don't introduce some unreliability. I was at a grand match here about a week ago, and the humorous part of this was the one guy shooting. All of a sudden, I hear, "Hey, do you have another 30-06 round I can borrow?" Because, as it turns out, he brought just enough ammo for the match, but one of his rounds, he'd seated the primer upside down in. So there's no way that was going to work. But very fortunately, there was a few extra rounds on the range, and someone was able to help him out. But you know, and that's just kind of the embarrassing thing that can happen, and that happens kind of all the time. I never forget, someone was a friend of mine was handing me a pistol to try. You know, he's like, "Hey, try this." And I forget what it was. I think it was a 38. I think it was a K38, but I'm not sure. And so he hands me some cartridges to go in it. Sure enough, I put it in, and one of them's got the primer seated upside down. I'm like, "Hey, I don't think this is going to work very well." And that happens when you kind of bulk hand load or hand load for, you know, reasons for economy, because for range ammo, hand loads are fine. You get a few anomalies like that, but you know, it's serious business, and you should have serious ammo for your defense guns, and that's factory ammo. That's not hand loads. So that's where I go off. It's just potentially too much can go on. Now, you talk to guys and they say, "My hand loads are the greatest thing on earth. They're within specification and all that." That's all well and good. Everybody's hand loads are kind of designed like that. And some people are better at quality control than others. I will tell you, I've gone from a point where I used to want to load for volume to the point where I just want to load for quality. And I don't care. If I can only do 50 rounds an hour out of my Dillon machine, then so be it. Because I'm going to check every single round to make sure that the primers are in right and the bullets right. And I check them to make sure they all have a powder charge. You know, all those good things that we want to do. That's, you know, quality is really the best thing. And quality hand loads, you feel a lot better when you're shooting them at the range and you know everything's been checked out. So anyway, In the Gravest Extreme, a great book, and if you can find a copy of it, it's even well worth the read today, I think. And you know, guys like Massad Ayoub, you know, there aren't a lot of that good thinkers around anymore. I mean, you go on YouTube and you just get tacti coolers, you know. They want to talk about the latest and greatest light to slap onto your AR or your shotgun, or why you need a laser, or why you need all the rest of this crud, or you know, the newest, latest free-floating handguard, and whether you should have a 20-inch barrel, an 18-inch barrel, a 16-inch barrel, a 14.5 with a permanently attached muzzle brake. You know, I mean, it goes on and on and on. It should definitely be looking at, hey, how is this going to work? Just beyond the equipment, beyond the mechanics, how does this societally work that I've just shot somebody? Because, you know, if you shoot and kill somebody, you know, your relationships, even casual relationships, you know, could be affected. What are the people at work going to think when you show up Monday morning? "Hey, how was your weekend?" "Oh, well, you know, some guy tried to break into the house, so I capped him." You know, I mean, chances are you're going to be on the news on some level. All of a sudden, you're going to be the kind of person that maybe people are like rah-rah and on your side, but there's going to be a lot of people who you probably deal with on a daily basis who are going to say, "Hey, I'm kind of staying away from you." Most people will tend to avoid what they consider to be an uncomfortable situation or position. So a whole lot of things will change, a whole lot of things will change, and it's really not a lot of your doing, especially if it's a righteous self-defense shoot. It's going to be, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. As a matter of fact, you did something right by defending yourself or defending another person, but there are things that will change. Oh, Masoud Ayoub would be a great guy to interview. And there are a few of the guys who back from the 80s and 90s are still around. They would be great to interview also. One of the ones, I think InRange TV did a really good job. They interviewed James Sullivan, the guy who's really the guy who brought out the AR-15. Not Stoner designed the AR-10 and kind of Stoner Sullivan together with really, I guess, mostly Sullivan. Scaled it down to the AR-15. Sullivan then worked on a bunch of other things, including the Mini 14. And so he would be a very interesting man to interview. I'm pretty sure the pictures I've just seen of him recently, he's up there in years. So, you know, we kind of want to learn everything we can from him and get the inside story he went while it's still able to be told. A very, very interesting guy. So, and maybe a great arms designer who's really underrated. I tend to think that he probably is a pretty brilliant engineer and really needs to rank up higher on the known names of great gun designers than he does today. Getting into a couple of other things here, it appears that there have been three NRA board members so far that we know about who've been stripped of all their committee assignments and responsibilities, and that appears to be in retaliation for them speaking up or questioning the leadership of Wayne LaPierre during the NRA annual meetings. So, I be honest with you, I take a very dim view of this. It looks like petty retaliation. It also looks like a suppression of dissent and free speech. I mean, you know, a board member, I kind of expect them, if we vote for them, to speak your mind. I mean, we vote for the board member so that they can, you know, express views. Now, if they're expressing views that are just flat wrong and all that, they will be held accountable in their next election. So, you know, let the members decide who speaks and what is considered great speech. I'll be honest with you, is some years ago they had a guy, Joaquin Jackson, some Border Patrol guy who they tried to make into a, you know, kind of a Bill Jordan, you know, one of these Border Patrol legends, you know, Harlan Carter and all these old NRA guys way back from the 40s, 50s, 60s. They hung on into the 70s. But, you know, there was that whole kind of gun writer, gun culture thing of the Border Patrol guys. It was Skeeter Skelton was one. Bill Jordan was one. Harlan Carter was one. And this guy, Joaquin Jackson, came along kind of just after that. But he made some idiotic remark in an interview that, you know, hey, civilians don't need more than 5 shots in a gun because that's really all that's, you know, you can have when you're legally hunting, you know. Now, I said at the time, I wrote in my blog, hey, this guy's got to go. He has got to go. If you say that as an NRA board member, I'm sorry. It's hasta la vista, baby, because you are not reflecting the views of the 99.9% of NRA members. You know, magazine bans and limits and all the rest of that. Hey, that's gun grabber propaganda garbage. And for it to come out of somebody like that was, of course, jumped on and used. I think at the time he was probably an old man and may not have been fully aware of what he was saying or how it was being used. But, you know, sorry, you got to go. That's why when I look at when they send me my ballot and I vote, I look and I say, hey, you know, who's over 80? I'm sorry, you're over 80 years old. You have to go. It's time for you to do something else because you can call that ageism, but I think we need a younger, more vibrant group of people to be in the NRA. to be on that board. The other thing I don't like, and I really don't like retaliation, petty retaliation, and they've posted a couple of these letters. I think Alan West and one of the other board members who've gotten them, they put pictures of these things on Facebook. They look authentic, so I'm going to accept them at their face value. And it's signed by the new president of the NRA, Carolyn Meadows, who, you know, who knows who she is. I assume she is a close ally of Wayne LaPierre and therefore, you know, is doing this to support him and consolidate, to stifle dissent and consolidate his control after, you know, an attempt was made to remove him from the organization. And I will tell you that I find that to be petty. It's like, first of all, hey, Wayne LaPierre, you want to strip the committee assignments? Hey, sign your own letter. You know, be a man, sign your own letter. Don't hide behind this figurehead. You know, come out, say it, and say this is why you're doing it. I think the biggest problem everybody's having is Chris Cox is gone, and nobody knows why. Other than, well, he kind of took part in the coup. Okay, well, you know, release it. Just tell us what it is. You know, tell us what it is. We're adults. We're members of an association, National Rifle Association. It's not, you know, we didn't enlist in some kind of odd paramilitary organization. This is an association of citizens that has certain goals, and some of them are legislative, some of them are training and competition, and oriented in a lot of different areas that are of interest to shooters. It's an association, so need to start acting like one is all I can say. And I don't really think it's very smart to drive away, you know, a guy like Alan West. And I'm sure they've probably have tried to talk to him offline, but you know, let the guy disagree. He's not a bad guy. He's a good guy. Let him disagree, because you know what? I'm sure he's a big enough man that when something comes up that he agrees with, he'll agree with you. But trying to stifle all dissent in a Soviet-style crackdown really seems to be small to me. So, you know, that's my opinion on what's been going on. Now, it appears that there's another kind of Soviet-style propaganda thing going on. The Virginia shooter. This guy was apparently, he's all those things that the media is afraid of in a shooter. He's a black Democrat and apparently a Muslim. Okay. None of those three things separately or together are evil. They're not evil. But they absolutely will not acknowledge. They don't like to acknowledge black crime. They don't like to acknowledge that Democrats are violent extremists. And they don't really want to cast the light that this guy was a Muslim, and that may have had some bearing. May have had no bearing, but it may have had some bearing. And they certainly don't want people to draw that inference. So, you know, they suppress this kind of information. And you always know it when you see it, when, yeah, the suspect's been identified, but can't seem to find a picture of him on the internet. But when it is a dirtbag like this Dylan Roof guy who went into a church and shot people who were worshiping, who he even admitted he had no grudge against, and that they were very nice to him, kind to him when he showed up and got in their church, they welcomed him there. And yet he shot them anyway, simply because of their race. Then all of a sudden, everything is under scrutiny. You know, there's a picture of him from years ago with a Rhodesian flag on a jacket. And therefore, anybody who expresses any historical interest in the military operations of Rhodesia must be a racist. Or, you know, that's how this whole Confederate flag thing started. He misused the Confederate flag. And then, you know, we've seen where that's gone. Monuments destroyed and taken down and all kinds of other just, you know, PC nonsense going on. A lot of the work that was done to mend the country after the Civil War has kind of been undone by this progressive BS group of people. And I would say that you know, that is not a healthy thing for a society which is already polarized. So, you know, again, a lot of people ask me, you know, one of the things I get asked is, well, why don't you, you know, listen to Good Morning America or the Big Three networks or MSNBC just to see what they're saying? Hey, I know what they're saying. I know propaganda. You know, it's like passing an outhouse. I don't have to hang around it to confirm to myself that it's a porta potty or an outhouse. Usually one smell is all I need. And it's the same thing. If you listen to MSNBC, if you listen to Good Morning America, if you listen to, you know, the Big Three networks, you're getting garbage. Even get some garbage on Fox. Frankly, I like Newsmax the best because it has news that actually has analysis and content to it. So, you know, just to let you know that things are not always as they appear with these incidences, and the perpetrators are not always, you know, these right-wing demons that they can go after. And when they realize what it is, they're all of a sudden quiet about it. Okay, let's move to my favorite part of the show, questions and answers. And these are, again, questions I've scooped up from a variety of sources or have been given to me. So I will basically do my best to address them as they come out. The first question is 9mm taking over the pistol world the same way that ARs are essentially taking over the rifle world? And I thought that was a very interesting question, because when you talk about ARs taking over the rifle world, you're talking about a variety of uses, a variety of calibers. My viewpoint is that a lot of the calibers are kind of redundant, silly, or don't really offer anything other than being different. But that's another, I'll address that at the end of this. 9mm, I don't know what the sales figures are. My assumption would be 9mm pistols outsell everything else by a fairly wide margin. And the reason I think that is because every companies do two things. Gun companies do two things. If they have capacity to make an AR-style rifle and a 1911 pistol, they make them. I mean, everybody makes them. Even Ruger makes them. Smith & Wesson makes them. You know, it goes on and on. Remington makes them. Anybody who's got the capacity to manufacture seems to manufacture those two things. But on top of that, the handgun manufacturers, people who are more traditionally into the handgun market, have a very heavy investment in 9mm. In service automatic style guns, and also in you know, smaller self-defense concealed carry type guns. It seems that 9mm is really the choice of all that. There are a couple different reasons for that. Number one is 9mm service pistols, especially polymer frame, striker-fired, very simple guns. Very little really goes wrong. It's a great gun to take to a shooting course where you're going to shoot 1,000 rounds over 4 days. It's just a good gun to have there. Other guns can do it too, but it's a good gun to have there. And if something does go wrong, you can fix it, you know, pretty quickly, just a part swap. And they usually have people on site who can do that. So 9mm is very popular for that. Number two is 9mm is very inexpensive. And it's one of those guns where the craptastic steel cased ammo really doesn't make a difference. I mean, you can take that, shoot it in your polymer frame 9, and it's just as good as shooting the brass case stuff. There's no endemic problems either in myth or reality that are happening there. So it's definitely a win, if you will, for economy. And you can buy that stuff in bulk. And, you know, I don't know of anybody who even hand loads 9mm anymore, just the time and cost effectiveness. And we'll talk about hand loading a little bit later. But so yes, 9mm is taking over the pistol world. A few areas that are still owned by different calibers and different style guns is some target shooting. If you really want a match grade gun and it's a semi-automatic, you're probably going to go to a 1911. That's probably what's out there, even though Walther and a few other few others are kind of, you know, toying with some target grade 9mm. I think target grade ammunition in 9mm is harder to come by. It's definitely a niche that they're going to try to get into. Unfortunately, there's very little pure target shooting left anymore. Most of it is 3-gun, possibly 2-gun, steel challenge, bowling pin, all these other kind of things, which really are really what they require is a service grade automatic anyway. So, you know, that's not the part of the market that 9mm does not own is probably pretty small. A few other things are the, you know, obviously, ultra power. I still think, I don't care what ammunition you have, 9mm is probably not a great woods gun. I've never had much luck with it. I much prefer to have a revolver with a very aggressive hollow point or something more powerful. And, you know, to get into the old bear attack, you know, the bear attack guns, you certainly want something larger than the 9mm. Some guys go, well, 10mm or whatever else. I would prefer something even greater than that. And, you know, I have a shoulder holster for a 50 caliber Desert Eagle. Now, if I can just climb up a tree high enough so that the bear is having at least some sort of, it delays the bear a little bit, I can draw that thing and probably pump a few rounds into him and take care of it. You know, but if my ability to climb trees is, as time goes on, my ability to climb trees or escape is becoming smaller and smaller. Therefore, I'm kind of needing firepower and kinetic energy to kind of even things up, because my ability to escape is getting pretty small. So I believe in large caliber, you know, Magnum style handguns for that. Now, I say that and the number of bears I have seen in the wild is uno. And I used to go out into the woods quite a bit more than I did now, but the number I've seen is uno. and that did not pose a threat. And at the time, I had a 303 jungle carbine, you know, British, you know, the shortened Enfield jungle carbine. It got the cool flash hider and all that on it, bolt gun. I had that with some soft point ammo. So this was not, I was prepared. I was loaded for bear, as they say, loaded for bear. And I think I saw this thing about 40, 50 yards away, and it actually ran in another direction. And I was just as happy because there were no complications. So, you know, but powerful anti-predator or anti-four-legged creature threat, that's something still a tiny sliver of the market, but that's still owned by something other than the 9mm. So yes, the 9mm is taking over the world. 40 Smith & Wesson tried to take over the world, but you know, it didn't offer enough. I still think they're really good guns. I think that the smartest thing somebody could do is, if you're kind of playing for the long term, is buy some of the really good quality police trade-ins out there. There are some SIGs and a few things. Hey, there are Glocks out there. You know, buy whatever you want. But I'd buy a couple of those and just hang on to them, because, you know, the pendulum will swing back. Somebody will, they will want them. In a couple of years, they'll want them. It wasn't that long ago, in the 90s, where you could buy Smith & Wesson police trade-in revolvers for modest prices. And I wish I'd scarfed up a bunch of those, because, you know, right now they sell for a pretty penny. So, you know, the things that are just, when something's unpopular, that may be an opportunity to get in. And when something's highly popular, that may be a time that you kind of just lay back a little bit, because when it cools off a little bit, you might be able to get better some better prices. And that's actually related to our next question. Are powerful handguns dead? And we kind of talked about this in an earlier podcast with, is the Magnum handgun era over? You know, I just don't see them as much as I would think you would at public ranges or anywhere else. People just aren't into them the way they used to be. And the people who are predominantly hunters or looking for, you know, that niche self-defense gun against four-legged creatures. They're the real cult of, you know, Magnum Power. It used to be a magazine called Magnum Power that's kind of went, all of it went to, you know, the powerful Magnum handguns. And you can thank Dirty Harry for that. he basically made, I think he saved Smith & Wesson from receivership in the 1970s. And definitely, you know, everybody wanted to, you know, shooting a Magnum was the deal. And kind of put the most popular cartridge up until that time was 38 Special, and it continued to be very, very popular. But what got all the headlines and all that was the latest and greatest Magnum. There were actually some great handgun writers who just specialized in Magnum pistols, and I think, you know, actually after years and years and years, some of those guys started having problems with their hands. If you're shooting a couple of hundred Magnum rounds a week, you know, your hand might wear out faster than your gun does. So, you know, that was another thing. Plus the, you know, you really need to be on top of hearing protection and just the expense. You know, we've talked about before the expense of some of these Magnum and Super Magnum rounds. So while they're not dead, they definitely are. They're definitely a niche that's in the background right now. Here's a related question to that. All these questions seem to be related. Is hand loading dead? You know, hand loading is not the ticket it once was. And that's a shame, because I think what hurt hand loading, and this is my strict opinion, but hand loading would be immensely more popular today when we had great ammo shortages, when people were panic buying all the loaded ammo they could, like after Sandy Hook, the latest example. If there had been a lot of components available, if the companies had kind of stockpiled for that, and the only way and the most efficient way you could get ammunition was to hand load it yourself, hand loading would have taken off. But they didn't do that. As ammunition ran out, so did powders, primers, bullets. And this is not the first time it's happened. You know, we've had primer shortages before. This time we had powder shortages. Lead, scrap lead to cast isn't as plentiful as it used to be. Car wheel weights are now made out of, well, they're made out of something else. I don't know what it is, but it's some goofy metal that can't use. They used to be lead, and it used to be you could just melt them up, get rid of the steel clips, and the alloy was just right and everything. So, you know, casting bullets, there's no substitute for primer. You just have to buy those, and there's really no substitute for powder. You have to buy that. So when powder and primers are in a short supply, you're done. You're you know, give it up. You're done. You know, so it would behoove those guys to keep a large supply of this stuff. I know that after Sandy Hook, there's one bullet company, they do lead bullets, that I buy from. and they were basically trying to figure out how to double their capacity to produce because the demand was so high. So hand loading could have, if there had been a lot of more stuff, if it was a viable alternative to not being able to purchase factory ammo, people would have been all over it. But the fact of the matter is, when people turned to it, you couldn't get the powder, you couldn't get the primers. Certain, you know, even dyes were out of stock. People were just buying, you know, hey, I can hand load, but I've never hand loaded 5.56 because it's always been cheap and plentiful. But now that it's no longer plentiful, you know, you couldn't buy 5.56 dice. So if you're an AR guy and you're shooting a lot of 5.56, you know, hand loading looks like a piece of garbage to you when you can't get bullets, you can't get powder, you can't get you can't get the dyes, you know. So you sit there and go, well, I can't get any of this. So other than just a box of ammo you can't get, now there's four or five other things you can't get. So that's one of the reasons. It's not dead, but it's not expanding. And the opportunity to grow hand loading as an industry and as a practice people would do is just not there. The other thing is, you know, hand loading has become its own hobby, and what they have done, which has not been very smart, is, you know, it's very labor intensive. And if a guy just wants to assemble inexpensive ammo, that's really a kind of impossible to do quickly. They never have, you know, all of our hand loading equipment is basically 1940s and 1950s tech. Outside of the electronic scales, maybe. And it's old-fashioned tool and die. It's even if you look at the Dillon machine, the springs, levers, and all of that is, you know, they even make a double action revolver look simple, you know. I mean, it's all spring levers and all that stuff. All that has to be adjusted, and that's all time consuming. And you know, that's just the way it goes. So, you know, they never made Dillon tried to make it so you could increase the volume, but they should have made it so that low volume guys, hey, maybe it takes an hour to turn out 50 rounds of something, as opposed to, you know, it takes hours to set this thing up, then you get it set and going, and then you can crank out thousands of rounds. Maybe that was a road that was fine for most, but not all. And they could have grown the hobby by basically saying, hey, you know, you've got 300, you know, 8mm Mauser pieces of empty brass, once fired brass. Well, here's a small compact machine that'll put in a standard load, use a standard bullet, standard primer, and, you know, basically in an afternoon you're going to crank out 300 rounds. Are they going to be match quality? No. It's going to be a volume charge, not a weight charge. You know, I mean, it they never investigated that. So that the guy who shoots his 98K Mauser in vintage rifle matches, hey, all of a sudden he's got some decent ball quality ammo that he can do, rather than paying, you know, $20 a box down at the store. So hand loading is not dead, but it does need to go, I think, in a different direction. And part of that direction is go to, you know, low volume, how to quickly make safe ammo, and, you know, go from there. Oh, custom 1911s. Kind of what we were talking about earlier. You know, I appreciate the artistry, the engineering, and all the great parts of a custom 1911, but, you know, using one for defense is foolish, absolutely foolish, because, you know, police are going to confiscate it. Now, if you make enough money that losing a $4,000 gun is not a big deal to you, well, then that's okay. Then that's fine. You know what it is, and when you get it back, I can't believe that they're in the same pristine condition that they got it in. So anyway, I find them great, but I just find them to be, it's kind of for the man who has everything. If you're serious about defense, you need to get in my opinion, and you want to use a 1911, you need to get a good, reliable base gun. And, you know, if you need better sights on it, fine, you know, but you don't spend a lot of money on these things, because you practice with them to become good with them and get that level of skill you need, but you don't invest a lot of money into them, because it could very well turn out that you use it on someone and then all of that is gone forever. So that's kind of what I think about custom 1911s. Now, if it's strictly for target or strictly for some other reason, then fine. Whatever the cost benefit is to you, then go with that. But for defense, no, I think they're a very bad choice. And going back to the only firearms media story that's out there, a very interested one by Larry Correa, who is a gun writer that goes back, I think he goes back to the 80s. He's you know, another guy who writes some interesting stuff. And in the firearms news, he wrote, you know, is Red Dawn a possibility? And on the surface, you go, oh, God, that's just so ridiculous. There's no way that, you know, the Russians and Cubans or the Chinese are not going to invade the United States. It's just not going to happen. But what could happen is you start looking at gun grabbing and, you know, look at a place like California where your defense options are just dwindling. Now they're going through a background check for ammunition. So your ability to procure ammunition, and you know the next step to that, the next step to that is a limit. Because the first thing they did was, you know, they had, well, all guns have to be safety tested. And then the next thing is, and you can only buy one gun a month, a one gun a month policy. Okay, well, I don't know who that hurts besides collectors, but, you know, so that they're going to do this, quote, background check on ammo. And the next thing that's going to happen is they're going to put a limit. You can only, you know, buy X number of rounds per year. So the only way you can stockpile ammo is if you don't shoot. You just buy ammo, hide it, and don't shoot. And I suppose you could go to across the border, buy ammunition, then bring it back to your house. But I bet there's going to be a deal where they figure out how much you bought and how much you're authorized and all this. If you have more, you're going to be in trouble. It's just the way that works. So California, you know, they're effectively being disarmed. Should that happen across the country, then where do we stand where it comes to MS-13, cartels, any other kind of criminal enterprise? No, we're not talking about a Red Dawn like a you know, paratroopers landing in the schoolyard and all this. That's not what we're talking about. What we're actually talking about are the, you know, we're slowly being disarmed and criminal elements are then much more free to prey on us. I mean, the insidious part of Democratic politicians, the absolutely horrid, insidious part of this is that they're going to leave you defenseless in front of some very, very hostile people who don't give a hoot about your rights, your property rights, or any of the rights you have in this society, because they're criminals and they don't care. MS-13, cartels, whatever other flavor of organized crime, or even just random crime, even just random criminals, even whether they're organized into street gangs or not, you're going to be defenseless in front of those if their gun control stuff passes. One of the beauties of the AR is the fact that that weapon will allow you to defend yourself against multiple attackers very efficiently. And that's a capability that, you know, if you have a brain, you do not want to give up. Other guns are, you know, almost as good, but the AR is the best at that. Absolutely the best. And it's basically versatile enough that you can customize it to whatever situation you have. If you are more worried about night intrusions or something, you can very easily slap a night vision device on it. Even a fairly simple one can be had for a few hundred dollars, and all of a sudden you're in business. You can see at night. If you live out in a rural place and somebody may be doing something and you need a scope to acquire them, to get them to stop, you can make that modular and definitely put that kind of a sight on it. You can put on lights and lasers and all these other goodies that people have for these things. Whatever it is you need, you can put on there. And they're targeting the AR rifle. I mean, to me, it used to be during the assault weapon ban, it was the AK-47 was the evil gun. Now the AR is the evil gun. And so they're going to target it and they want to take it from you. And when they do that, we'll be in real trouble as a society, because all of a sudden there's going to be a lot of local thugs that are effectively going to be running things, because the police are just too thin to stop it. And when somebody threatens to burn down your house, kill your children, do whatever it is they're going to do, when they threaten to do that, most people will acquiesce and give them the money or give them what they want, as opposed to standing up and fighting on it. When these guys invade your house, these Democrats want to change the law so that when your house is invaded, you have to retreat. I mean, that can't work in society. That means that some guy starts breaking down my back door, I better run out the front door and run down the street, because I no longer have the legal right to defend myself. And that's what these stand your ground laws, castle laws, you know, that's why they want to target those too. I mean, we don't live in a utopia, we never will. And the fact of the matter is, what will keep our society strong are good people stopping bad people from doing things. And we have to have the tools to do that. So I sit there and say it's not really Red Dawn. It's really more of Blue Dawn would be the way I would call it. You know, don't live in a blue state. And if you're in Nevada, do what you can to try to convert it back. Nevada, Virginia, you know, wake up. Get people to wake up. Take a new person shooting. You know, one of the best things you can ever do is take somebody who's got a relatively open mind, take them shooting and show them, hey, this is the weapon, this is what it does. It's not a death, you know, counter some of that propaganda. And you'll not only will you get somebody thinking more clearly, but you'll also maybe even convert somebody to the sport who says, hey, I like this and I kind of want to do it. This is a great thing. And even on a sport level, you know, even if they're not interested in self-defense or the rest of it, they just want to do it as a sport. Hey, that's a big win for us right there. A great big win. So definitely keep that in mind to take a new person shooting. Well, this is it for this episode of Old School Guns. Again, if you enjoy what you hear, please hit the follow button and you'll get a notification as to when the next episode posts. Go ahead and do that, and we'll have we'll have some more teed up for you. We'll see if we can finally get onto a network or maybe even go from there. As far as sponsorship goes, I'm not opposed to it, but I don't solicit it or seek it out, and I will never be beholding, and I will never be hawking for a sponsor. They sell good stuff, great, I'll tell them. If they sell stuff that's not very good, they won't be a sponsor, and I won't even mention it, won't even know that they applied. So anyway, this is Old School Guns out.